Welcome to Leadership Bites with myself, your host, Guy Bloom. This is a leadership podcast where I have conversations with colleagues, I chat with guests, and sometimes they'll be just me talking. You can connect with me at livingbrave.com, and when you enjoy the episode, subscribe and please tell everyone. Nina, fantastic to have you on this episode of Leadership Bites. Welcome.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm really chuffed to be here, Guy.
And I'm really excited to have you on as well. And, you know, we've been talking just about a few things before we got started. But I think just for those people that don't know you, because I always say on these things that I invite you so I know who you are, but just to introduce yourself and let people know who you are.
Yeah, sure. For those people who don't know me, my name's Nina Olk. The surname's always been a bit of a difficult one, but I love it regardless. I'm an activist. I speak out about honour killings, human trafficking, mental health in young men, amongst other things. I coach elite athletes, usually within the fighting world, MMA, boxing, but I also have some clients that are footballers, but it's always sports people, which I love. I love doing that.
Which is fascinating because I've been a lifelong martial artist as well. So I was too old for MMA. If I stepped in the ring now, they'd probably snap me in half, but there we go. Never say that. We'll see where we go. So listen, Nina, you have a very particular story that I don't want to get in the way of, I think is probably the easiest way of me saying it. So I think I'm going to just ask you to bring your narrative, your story and your journey to life. And if I think I can add value, then I'll come in with some questions, probably for my own clarity, which might help other people. But you know, just Nina, just start talking about you and how we got to be here today.
Yeah, definitely. So we connected on LinkedIn. I'm super pleased we did. Most of my messages on LinkedIn are, you need to be beheaded because you bring shame upon your culture and your family. And some of that will make a little bit of sense because it's quite a important statement. The whole honour is the thing that I'm fighting about. When I say fighting, I'm trying to spread awareness. I'm obviously a girl or a woman born into a culture which is very common in this mentality to be in Africa, Middle East and Asia. The mentality of having a daughter but not really wanting that daughter. When I was born, my parents didn't want me, so I was left in my pushchair for days, apparently, according to my aunt, without being looked after. And apparently I stopped crying after a few days because I knew nobody was coming, so that's why babies cry normally. But my childhood was pretty much along those lines. I was abused by one of my brothers, when I was 6 or 7. I didn't really understand what was happening or what he was doing. I didn't even know it was wrong because I didn't have any human interaction with the family because as a girl, we're not allowed to mix with anybody. We have to keep our eyes down in the house. We are only allowed to do chores, domestic chores, and called upon. Otherwise, we don't talk out of line. We don't even come back from school and say, hey, guess what I did today? There's none of that. You will just take your coat off, put it away, go upstairs, change into your home clothes, as they call them, usually Indian clothes, because my parents are from North India, and you would start your chores. And I had a whole list of chores. So by the age of 6, I was literally a servant in the house, a domestic servant. My day used to really start very early at 5 o'clock in the morning. One of the biggest memories I have of childhood is I went to the kitchen one day and there was a blue crate. And I remember doing a little dance, a little jig, because I was so happy. And for most people, they wouldn't understand that. But my life was difficult reaching the cabinets and reaching the work surface and the cooker. And I used to really struggle because I wasn't the tallest of people. My family are all 6 foot tall. My father's an ex-wrestler, professional wrestler in the days of Big Daddy here, you know, in the UK. So they were all huge people. I was tiny. And this blue crate changed my life. I remember being so happy about it. I turned upside down. I stood on it. I came off it. I went on it. I came off it. I went on it. And I just was so pleased because I could reach everything. And that meant everything was quicker. And that was pretty much my life. I was quite happy with it because I didn't know any different. So not having a parent look after you or talk to you or do your hair or wash your clothes was normality for me. My mum didn't allow me to wash my clothes so much because I didn't deserve that. She told me quite clearly. So I didn't. And I was that dirty child at school. And I always say to people, you know, my children used to ask me why I was particularly nice to one girl at school who was always quite dirty at their school. And I'd say, you don't know her story. You know, do you think the child, you've got a mummy that cleans and washes your clothes for you. Maybe she doesn't have that. So I always ask people just to consider what the other person might have gone through or is going through. And that was what childhood was like for me. But I knew I was so lucky, and I was reminded of how lucky I was by my parents, because people that were my parents' age were having baby girls. They were not registering the birth, so they would go to the hospital. I would see them pregnant. They would go to the hospital. Sometimes they would have the baby at home, and that baby would never be seen again. And it upsets me because I know it was happening, but they were literally putting the babies into plastic bags and suffocating them because they were born girls. And no child deserves that at all. So I knew I was one of the lucky ones.
Which country are you in at this time?
I'm in Leicester, which is 2 hours away from London, the United Kingdom.
Okay.
Sorry, I get a little bit upset. It's quite a horrific memory, I'll be honest. Yeah. I think I always feel worse when I know it's about somebody else as well, not necessarily myself. I have that empathy. But this all happened in the United Kingdom. As I said, I'm born and raised in the United Kingdom. And this happens all over the world because people from the Middle East are not living just in the Middle East. People from India, Africa are not just living in India or Africa. We're a multiracial, nationalities are from all over the place. So as a human race, we have such diversity. And the problem I have always said is my parents packed in their luggage very tightly their cultural beliefs. They never let them go. And a lot of people are like that. Life went on as normal to me, what was normality for me, until 14. And that's when I realized that my life was very, very, very wrong. I had the job of always cooking and cleaning for my father and his friends when they came back from the pub. You know, on a Saturday night, they'd go out and he'd bring back 7 or 8 people back every week. And I'd been seeing this since I was probably 10. They all knew me. They spoke to me. I didn't speak to anybody. As I said, as a girl, you have your head down, especially when men have been drinking, you don't put your head up. And on this particular night, my father was taking a long time to finish his food. It would have been probably 1 or 2 a.m. in the morning. I sat on the bottom step. We had a large staircase. I think a lot of people did back then, wooden staircases. And I sat playing with my feet, you know, waiting, wanting to go to bed. I'm a little bit older now. I'm maturing. I've started my period. So, you know, I'm going through that hormonal change and I just want to go to bed. And my father called me, as he normally did. Everything was as normal, to pick up the plates, which was my job. I had the tray in my hand ready. And as I walked in, my father grabbed my wrist and they threw all the plates off the table. And I remember thinking, the plates are breaking, the plates are breaking. That's what was my first thought, not really understanding what was happening. And they took turns in raping me, but it wasn't a rape as I describe it. It was more of a horrific attack in the sense of I was beaten. And I know my father from his voice and touch and movement, because being told you have to stay in your room all the time gives you your hearing a more acute sense, so you can hear things that other people can't. You know who is moving, who is walking, who is sneezing, because you recognize those sounds, because the sight, this, you know, the ability to see is gone and you are relying more on your hearing. And I, as a kid, used to put my ear against the door in my bedroom, listening all the time, because I wanted desperately to be part of this family. But that night, it just seemed to go on forever. And I kept my eyes wide shut. I really did. And I remember trying to breathe, because I felt quite a few times I couldn't breathe. When I did come to, I was lying literally in a pool of blood on this carpet. It was very harsh. My father had bought this carpet that I didn't like, to be honest with you, but he went on and on about it. And my immediate reaction was, well, how do I get the carpet clean? And I've got to pick up the plates before somebody comes in, because I'll be told off. I had this whole fear of being told off, that I would be in trouble, not really taking a moment to understand what had just happened to me. And I was very, very young and naive. I literally lived in a bubble until 6 years ago, if I'm being honest. So I didn't see the severity of it, but I knew instinctively my whole body was rejecting this feeling that I felt very, very wrong. And my mother put her head through the door, which made me get up quicker because I was scared that I was going to be told off. I picked up the plates and put them on the tray. Some of them were broken, some of them weren't. I took them in the kitchen. I wasn't dressed because they had ripped my clothes off, and I was, as I said, covered in blood. And I couldn't really walk, if I'm being honest. I was in a lot of pain, not just because of the rape, but because, as I said, they were very violent, and these are grown men. That led to a pregnancy, and I had to tell my mother that I wasn't having my periods, but she knew because I used to have to ask her for the sanitary towels and things. And I was taken to a clinic, and most people would think that's a traumatic experience, but it was the first time I encountered kindness, I'll be honest. If I look deep into my memory, I know exactly what happened at the clinic, but my memory of the clinic is that I was sitting on a grass verge somewhere in, I think it was Yorkshire, and a lady brought me a cup of tea, and she put a hand on my head and stroked my head. I didn't look up because we're not supposed to, but that was such a vivid memory because nobody had touched me. Nobody had been kind to me. Nobody had expressed any love or affection. So for me, I sat there thinking, wow, she touched my hair and my hair's dirty, and she gave me a biscuit with my tea. And I love the tea, you know, and it became one of my things. I love a cup of tea. But after that, I became exceptionally depressed. I just wanted to die, I'll be honest. At school, nobody saw the signs. I went from being an A-star student, being the people pleaser I'd become, to somebody who was just very withdrawn. And I know that somebody could have picked it up. So if anybody's out there listening that works with children or sees a child become an extreme to what they were, please understand it's not coming from just anywhere or teenagers growing up. It's not the case. There's always something that's causing that reaction, and you don't have to look into it, but maybe you can make a discreet call of concern. Because if somebody had done that for me, I would have definitely not been subdued to so much more trauma as I was. When I did come back from school one day, I decided to end everything. I'd heard some girls talking at school about paracetamols, and I didn't know very much. So we didn't have Google in those days. I literally picked up, we had tubs of paracetamols back then, not packets. And I picked up the tub, the capsules were quite big, and literally swallowed them all. And I didn't understand the pain that you go through when you try to do this. And if anyone's out there who has tried to kill themselves with this means, you'll know that it's a painful experience because your body goes through a certain level of pain. And to be almost in a position where you wake up just to want to go back to sleep, that you wake up not really wanting to be there, and every day is so difficult, you know, my heart goes out to you. I wish I'd spoken to somebody. And if anybody's out there that is feeling that way, that's what you need to do. You need to go and speak to somebody, because someone out there will help you or listen. And that's what I needed, somebody just to listen to me. My parents found me and beat me. And again, I was at the top of the stairs this time. I was in another pool of blood, because they don't beat you. They try to almost end your life. And I remember lying there with my face on the wooden staircase. It was like a landing, thinking, I just don't care anymore. You know, do what you want. I just don't care. And I had no self-worth, no self-esteem. So, and that was that. But because my father said I had spoilt myself, one of the men that had stayed right to the end, who continually raped me, came forward and said, because she spoiled herself, how about we do a trade? If you give me some money and some things and gold, I'll have her in my house. I have a son who has a girlfriend. She's English, which is a common thing back then that a lot of Asian boys were dating English girls, but they weren't allowed to be open with it. But the parents knew because he refused to get married. So my father made this trade, this fake marriage, that I would marry one of the perpetrator's sons. So I could be there for him sexually to be abused, but also as a servant. So that's what happened. At 14, this was agreed. 15, the marriage was arranged. And I was a child bride at the age of 16, just literally, I think I turned 17 in my marital home. And this was a totally different area of Leicester that I didn't know about. My father was from quite a well-to-do family, and he was very successful. As I said, he was a professional wrestler, but he also was very good with his business. Excuse me. My marriage was, it lasted 4 years. I constantly fought against my father-in-law. My mother-in-law knew what was going on. My husband, on paper, never looked at me or spoke to me. And I was literally serving food, washing clothes. But the mistake they made was they encouraged me to go and find a job. And being the person I am, the people pleaser, I went into a large corporation, worked three times as hard as the person next to me, and became a manager at the age of 19. And I was doing exceptionally well, but they were very greedy for money. So they told me to go and get another job in addition to my day job. So I was working another job, which I was happy to do because it meant I spent less time in the house. But at this particular job, the people were slightly different and they were a little bit more nosy and more outspoken. And they said, "Why are your ankles bleeding?" And I could say at my other job, "Oh, it's nothing." And they would leave me alone. But at this job, they were very, "No, Nina, what's happening? What's going on?" I was selling kitchens at this job, so you can imagine, the type of people that are there as well. Very mouthy people, very vocal. And I started to cry, and I didn't cry very easily. I've never cried because I know by crying, nothing happens. No one comes to save you or put their arm around you or pick you up. So I've never been one to cry. But the reason they were bleeding was my father-in-law had this thing that he would tie me up with a coat hanger. And in those days, coat hangers were very harsh and very thick, and they had jagged edges. And when he would wrap the coat hanger around me after unwrapping it, it would always dig into my skin and literally rip away the flesh on my ankles. I couldn't move, and sometimes he'd leave me like that and go out for hours, and I used to literally wee myself because I had no option. That led me to them telling me that this is all wrong. And I'm sat listening, thinking, is it wrong? Because all I knew was violence. But when you're in a situation, you never really see the danger you're in. Someone on the outside always sees things a lot clearer. So if someone's telling you something, it's actually worth listening to. My mistake was I romanticized going back home. Then my mom and dad would stand there with open arms and say, "Come home, darling. We want to look after you. What's wrong?" I'd seen parents around the town centre doing this with their young children. I'd listened to my colleagues at work in the corporate company that I was working for talk about their children. And I was always a bit of a dreamer, being stuck in my room on my own as a child. All I did was read books. I thought I was Rapunzel at one point and that somebody would just come and save me. But that was never the case. And I turned up at my parents' house, and my father hadn't seen me for 4 years because in our culture, we don't go back home. They don't have anything to do with you when you're married. There's no communication. You may see each other at a wedding, but again, I was never allowed to go anywhere out of the house. And he looked at me in disgust and asked me what I was doing there and told me to go. I naturally started to cry and plead. And I remember holding my hands together, literally pleading, saying, "Please, please, can I stay here? He's doing things I don't like, and I just want to come home." But there was another reason I needed to go home. And that was because my neighbors had set their daughter-in-law alight by pouring petrol upon her. And I was walking home one day from work, and I heard screams. Then I heard the police. Then I heard the ambulance. And then I knew that because she hadn't had a baby boy, that's what they did. And the police at that point were being called left, right and centre for where I lived. This was a common thing. And people were saying, well, she's committed suicide. And the police didn't really want to investigate. They didn't want to get involved with the community because it was a difficult, very violent, very angry community. And I'm not making excuses for them, but I never saw any of them do anything about it. And this particular girl I knew, you know, we'd exchanged looks over hanging clothes and washing lines over the fence because that's the way life used to be back in the 90s. And my heart sank because I knew that would be me very soon. And that pushed me also to go back to my parents. But my father grabbed me by my hair. He pulled me into the house and I knew that I'd made a huge mistake. He started to just beat me. But whilst he was beating me, he was telling me that I brought shame upon him. People would know that I'd left an arranged marriage. People knew that I hadn't had a baby. They're going to think that something's wrong with him, that he produced me and that I'm this girl. Why can't I be like everyone else? Why can't I just have a child? Why do I have to fight things? Do I not know what I am? I'm a prostitute. I'm this. And he carried on with his verbal abuse whilst he started to hit me, called my brother. My brother's 6 foot tall, as I said. My mother came and stood literally with her arms crossed watching. And I sometimes used to think, was she unable to help? But nobody forces an expression on someone's face. And I'm very good at reading faces now. And I was back then because I didn't get to look at faces. So I would look deeper than just look. I would actually study a face. She was angry with me. She had no maternal instinct to save me or stop me, stop them rather, beating me. And she wasn't alone. My other brother's wife was there. She watched as well, and they watched the whole thing. And I was quite a young 21-year-old mentally, physically. I was tiny, and they were throwing me from wall to wall. Something was going to break, and the first thing was my jaw and then my arm. They dislocated my hip, and then when I fell down, they stamped upon me to the point where they literally broke every bone in my body, but they broke my spirit. And I remember lying there thinking, I'm not really here, am I? And I don't know what they're doing anymore, and I'm going to go now. And I looked down at the carpet, the same carpet, and blood was starting to drip on the carpet from my nose. And I thought, I really don't like this carpet at all. And I was left there for days because my other brother came back. He was at university and said, don't kill her here. We can't. So they all agreed whilst I was lying there to take me to India to finish it off there. And on the second day of me lying there, unable to move, I mean, I'm not able to go to the loo, so I'm weeing on the carpet, I'm doing everything there. An aunt came round, and when I say auntie, in those days we used to have mum's friends that were friends, but we call them aunties. And she said, get out. They're going to take you to India. When you get to the security, tell the security man at the airport that you need help because they're going to kill you. They've got a plan. You're not coming back. I've known you as a child, but I have to go. And she rushed out. So it was a very like rushed conversation. And then she's suddenly gone. I couldn't even move my head at this point, but I knew I had to do something. I wasn't ready to die. So many times people had tried to kill me and they couldn't. And I just thought, I'm not going to die now. So somehow I got the strength to go on my fours. I was on my knees and hands and I started to crawl like a baby, pull myself along, and I'd got to the door. Then I stayed there for a little while. Then I got myself to the next door and then I stayed there. Then I managed to get myself into the kitchen and over across the road to a park. I don't know how I did it because we had a 6 foot wall, a fence. But I think when you mentally say to yourself, I'm going to do this, you can do it, which I suppose is why I'm a mindset coach now. And you shift, something in your mindset just shifts. The pain, the physical pain I was in, was, I can't describe it. I still remember it. But all of that had almost been put aside, and I had got to where I needed to be. And from there, I fell asleep or passed out. But I saw my father going past in his car, and I was thinking, what am I going to do? And when daylight broke, it was so early, everybody was still asleep. But remember, this is the person that would get up at 5 every morning to do her chores. So I'm an early riser. I made my way somehow to a taxi rank, which wasn't too far away. And the chap there was so lovely. He said, "Is somebody after you?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Where do you need to go?" "A hospital." And I said, "No, I have a friend." And I told him where my friend was. He put me on the back seat, covered me up with a blanket, and he could have been a maniac, but you know what? He was a blessing in disguise. He got me to where I needed to be. I had no money, so I borrowed it from the news agents that he dropped me outside a news agent. And I knew the news agent was my friend's landlady, so she was quite happy to help. And she could see I looked like something out of a horror movie, that, you know, my body was covered in blood and my face was matted with my hair. I suppose it was quite a scary sight. My friend wasn't there, or it was too early. He didn't answer the door. I knew him because him and his girlfriend were always the ones at my second job saying, "Come to us if you ever need anything, come to us if you need anything." But they weren't there. So I walked across to the police station. And the first thing the police said to me is, "What happened?" Naturally, that's what they would ask. And when I said, "I've just survived an honour killing," they said, "Oh, you need a hospital." And that was the last I saw of the police. I ended up in the hospital for quite a while. And then I ended up in a women's hostel, which I couldn't hack because I hadn't seen women drinking. I hadn't seen women taking drugs. I understand these women were fighting their own demons, trying to numb their own pain. But for me, it was a scary concept. You know, I was this prim and proper girl that was born into a culture where women don't even talk to one another. They are just literally not seen. They have their job, they have their role. At work, I had a different kind of persona. I was very loud and happy. It was an escape. But even there, I knew my boundaries, and suddenly I didn't know how to react or what to do here. I felt for them, but I also was struggling myself. So I left in search of my friend again and got a bus, and I got there, and I'm still not really healing. You know, I'm still very physically hurt. It's just going to take a long time to get over my injuries. And I'm stood at the door, and he says, "Oh, we split up, but you can rent a room if you want to. I have a spare room. It'll cost you X amount." I didn't think about the money because I've always had this mentality that the money will come. And I rented the room, and I got a job in the local council. Very good job. My parents tried to find me. Somebody had tipped them off I was in this town. So I gave up the job. But I'd saved up enough to give him the rent because what do I spend on? I don't get my hair done, I don't get my nails done, I don't even eat. So I don't need very much money. And he took me out one day to the landlord's party. We didn't really talk. We were more flatmates than friends, if I'm being honest. There was something about him I didn't necessarily like. He was an African person, but he'd come to the country when he was 16. And I drank Malibu for the first time in my life. But the mixes were so strong. I think there was more Malibu than the mixer. And when you've never drank in your life and you're not a very heavy person, it just knocks you out. And I remember going back to the flat, opening the door and just falling forwards. And then 2 months later, I realised I'm pregnant. I asked him, "Has something happened?" Of course, you wanted this. I didn't want this, you know, and I believed him because who am I to question? I'm the problem. I've always been the problem. But something in me was really happy that I might be pregnant, I might have a child, and something knew it was a girl. And to cut a long story short, I gave birth to my daughter, and she gave me reason to live. She gave me a purpose. She gave me such drive that suddenly I became this person that was going to give her everything she ever wanted that I never had. And I broke a cycle of celebrating a girl. I wasn't unhappy that she was born. I was so happy internally. And the love a child gives you is, if anybody's a parent listening, they'll know that first touch, that first look, that they're just bundles of joy, and they really are. And she changed my life. Many a time she has saved my life, believe me. And then from there, I in my head reading all my little fairy books and tales and having this romanticized idea of life, I said, well, let's live together, you know. We weren't really together ever. He went off and did his own thing, went to the pub, was abusive, was mentally abusive, but that was okay because, hey, what did I know? I didn't know any different. And I was with him for 23 years. And in those 23 years, I had a son, my second child, who he actually celebrated. He seemed to like this second child more than the first. But by now, I'd started a mobile phone shop because everybody wanted a mobile phone in the 90s. It was an easy sell. I decided I wasn't selling them out of my flat anymore because I'd converted one of the rooms into an office. I'm going to go and get myself a rental property in town in the center. And that's what I did. And I developed this shop that sold mobile phones. But what's the next thing coming on? Computers. Let's sell computers. And I was actually making them myself, buying the bits, putting them all together. Then I hired somebody. I understood delegating is one of the best things you could ever do to progress in life. And I started to delegate. And before I knew it, my entrepreneurial side was, it was really sort of flying. And I ended up buying the shop I was renting. I ended up buying the property next door. I had my home. It was the white picket fence with, you know, just like my dreams and my pictures. And then I got pregnant again. By now, my partner had given his job up. He was spending a lot of money because the money was very attractive for him. And I didn't know how to manage money myself. So he was allowed to manage the money because he's the man. He's the man. He knows what he's doing. And his control had become obsessional to the point where I was tracked. I was watched on CCTV. My children were not allowed to see friends or have friends. Straight from school, they came home. They were sports, very sporty. So I put them into football because I like football. And I would do the drills with them in the mornings and everything. And they got into academies. They were playing for a Premier League academy. And they were doing really well. But on the outside, we looked like the perfect family. But on the inside, it wasn't the case at all. When I was pregnant for the third time, I was really tired with this pregnancy. I got pregnant quite quickly after the second baby was born. And I think I was 5-6 months in and I was sleeping. And I was sleeping and I woke up to the smell of burning hair. I don't know if anyone's ever smelt burning hair, but it's very distinctive. And I looked up and my partner stood near my bed. I realized he'd set my pillow on fire and my daughter had saved me in this situation before by coming in because she smelt fire. And this is the second time it's happening. And I'm thinking, why are you doing this? And I asked him, why are you doing this? And he said he wants to end it all. It took me years later on to work out that when somebody wants to end it all, they do something to themselves, not the other person. But I didn't see that because I was so knee deep in my belief of what he told me, that if he told me the sky was red, purple, and blue with spots, I would have believed it at that point. I'd been sort of programmed almost to believe what people around me were telling me. And I believed I was nobody. I believed I was nothing, but I knew I was a good mother. I knew I was good at business. But other than that, I had no self-worth. Cut a long story short, because it was 23 years of abuse. My daughter went off to university. She was studying to be a biomedical scientist. My son I sent to boarding school because his father had hit him. So that meant I had to go and start another business to pay for this school, which was my solution to everything. I'll just start another business. I'll just start printing and go into fashion. But my youngest son was left alone without a sister. He was left without his buffer. His brother was his buffer. Every time my head was slammed against the door or I was pushed down the stairs, he was that buffer for my son. In between the two boys, I had been pushed down the stairs and I'd ended up in hospital and I gave birth to my third child who died a few minutes after he was born. It was really difficult because I was in a maternity ward where children being born, I can hear the screams and cries. And my baby wasn't doing anything. And then I nearly died. So when I had my fourth child, I needed him for selfish reasons. I needed to have what was taken from me, and I felt God had taken from me. I really did, and I never really got over that. It still hurts to know that you go through that and come out of it with empty arms. Again, I won't wish that upon anyone. But I know things happen for a reason. And my youngest child is, again, someone that has taught me so much. He has his own purpose, I'm sure, which we'll discover at some point. But he was left with me with this monster that I say I married. And he developed an autoimmune disease because he couldn't cope with the stress. He started to self-harm. He was 13, 14 years old. He was dropped by his academy because he wasn't performing well enough, not knowing there was a medical reason behind it. And I started to take him to the doctors. My daughter started to tell me there was something probably of an autoimmune type of disease that he had. She knew about genetics, and he ended up being diagnosed with Crohn's disease quite severely, needing operations. And when we came out of hospital one day, I fell asleep on the sofa, and so did he. Or so it seemed that we were asleep. My partner sent a picture to my daughter saying, "I'm sorry." She wasn't allowed to speak to me because he'd broken our communication years before, because she was telling me things were not okay and she wanted me to leave him. So because of that, the communication was stopped and I couldn't communicate with her. But she sent me a message and I thought, well, he's not here. I can maybe look at it. But I was so sleepy, I couldn't seem to wake myself up. And she kept ringing the phone, and she's walked out of a lecture theatre. She's crying. She thinks I'm dead because I didn't sleep, because I had insomnia since my pillow was set alight twice. I had this fear of being set alight from the marriage that I was in. So that fear just took over my need for sleep, and I would go for days without sleeping. I also was scared of sleeping because my partner used to lock us in our rooms at 11 o'clock at night, and he would open the rooms at 5 a.m. So that 5 a.m. has always stayed with me as well. But when my son got ill, I was always scared he needs the loo, or he might be needing me and I can't get to him. What do I do? So to her, that she felt I was dead in the picture. And with the words, "I'm sorry, what would you think if you know your father's abusive and has done such things?" Eventually I woke up because she rang the base of one of the phones. We had two phones, a Virgin line and a BT line, because if you were on the phone to someone, he wanted to know who you were on the phone to. So he installed two lines, but that phone didn't work very well. The base rang really loud, but the phone never worked. And she remembered, and she rang that number and woke me up. And then she rang my mobile after a few minutes, and I answered, and I said, I'm sleeping. What's wrong? You know, she was screaming at me. And I said, "Let me get some water," because my throat felt parched. And when I went to the kitchen, I'd realized he turned on all the taps of the cooker, and the house actually smelt and tasted of gas. So it was literally an explosion waiting to happen. And still in this mindset of, I'm not allowed to leave, I can't leave, not looking at the importance of saving both my sons and my own life. My daughter had saved us by calling us and waking us up. But I took him and I lifted him up and I took him upstairs, and we fell asleep, or we passed out, I don't know which. But again, I woke up at 11 o'clock when the door was locked, and I realized that I wasn't alone in the house anymore. So that opportunity of escaping had gone. When my son got better after his operation, which was probably a month later, he went and told the school straight away. The school removed us very quickly. They questioned my ability to parent, because if you know that you're in a house where your pillow's been set on light, why would you allow your child to be there? But I was so blindsided, I didn't see that. And I told them I would do anything, but they couldn't take away my son from me. They placed us into an emergency accommodation, and again, I didn't really know much about the emergency accommodation, but I knew it was coming because they'd warned me. I'd paid my son's boarding fees, I'd paid my other son's school fees, I'd paid my daughter's university fees, but I didn't think to save some money for us because I've got a bank card, right? But when they came to take us, you don't take a bank card, you take nothing. I've got no cash. I think I had £5 that I saw on the side and grabbed it. But when you're in a panic and you've got 5 minutes to leave home, what do you take first? What do you pick up? I picked up a plastic hammer that was my son's childhood toy. I didn't know what I was doing. And I'm a very able woman in the professional field, but I couldn't think twice what to do. So my son's in his shorts, not practical. I grabbed a coat. I think he grabbed a little blanket that was on the side, and we went. And we went to an accommodation that's a secret location. But the secret location, when I opened the door, was terrible for anybody. It was inhabitable. As I stepped onto the carpet, literally the carpets were sodden with urine. There was human feces all over the walls. And I'm thinking, I worked really hard to create this life for my children. We lived in an 8-bedroom house that I actually built the extension myself. Every night I'd be there with the nail gun enjoying this building process. Where have I brought him? He's ill. He's not long come out of hospital. Where have I brought my boy? And they leave you there. They leave you, they go, and you're there without food, there without money for the meters, because I didn't know how to work a meter, that you have to put money on this little card and it goes in this slot and then you have electricity. I'm not from that life. I just switched on a switch and there the light was, the electric was. I didn't know any better. But I'm telling him it's going to be okay. And there's nothing to clean with, and I'm a little bit OCD anyway. And I wrap my coat around him and lay him on the bed because he's physically exhausted. He's just been taken away from his home in a very almost unbelievable way. And you're trying to understand, you've walked away from everything you've known, your life, your things, my things, they're still my things. And I didn't know what to do. And I sat in the other room and I started to cry, and I haven't cried for years. And I don't know if anybody's listening that's cried this way, but I was crying without making noise. I'm trying not to make any noise. And it's one of those sobbing cries. And I look down and I have literally a pool of tears. And I said to myself, Nina, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? You're either going to drown in these tears or you will dance in them. And I stood up and I started jumping up and down. People probably thought I was crazy if they could see us, because there were no curtains either in this place. But I was crying and jumping and telling myself, no, you have someone who relies on you. You've done it before. You can do it again. That led to homelessness, because when you in the UK have a business, you can't claim benefits. When you're a homeowner, you don't get as much help. So we became homeless after probably a week and a half, which was probably the most difficult time of my life. Again, you question everything. You question your decisions. You question whether you can. You question who you are as a parent. And people ignore you. They walk past you like you're invisible. And when you've had that since childhood, it's hard. I am, again, one of the lucky ones. Somebody realised from the school what was happening and asked if we could live with her. And I call her one of Earth's angels. She allowed me to stay at her house for 30 days. Well, there was no time limit, but in my head, there has to be a time limit because I'm a very independent, able person, right? So I stayed there for a month and I worked as a nanny. I cleaned offices, the same offices I was selling thousands of pounds worth of equipment. I was cleaning their offices, the same factories in Leicester that I was taking large corporations to buy clothing. I was packing garments for £3 an hour. I was doing everything within my respectful understanding of work. to save money so I could rent a place. And I did. I made enough money within a month and we found the perfect place. It was hidden away. And I was nesting. I was trying to save money or get things from other people that they were giving away so I could give my son a home. But I lost something on the way, and that was my son. I didn't give him any time. And this is my plea to parents, to listen to your children when they try to speak to you, because often we are on the phone or we have somebody calling for work and we don't pay attention. So not only to your children, to each other, stop what you're doing, take a pause and listen. Be present. Be there for them, because I wasn't there for my son. And he borrowed some money from somebody, left me a note and ran away. My heart broke because I didn't know what to do. I read the note and it said he'd heard voices in his head and he was in a lot of pain. And I suddenly thought to myself, if you were 14 years old, you've been dropped by your club, your brother's gone away, you've lost your home comforts, you've developed an illness that's a disability, how would you feel? Did I ever ask him? No, I didn't. He's become homeless. He's watched things and seen things he never should have seen living with his father. So I knew I had to do something, and I swore to God that he wouldn't take this child from me. I was one of those people that drew on the wall and made a little timeline and, you know, trying to track him. And we tracked him to Miami. He'd gone over there because he had this obsession with Batman and the actors, Keith Ledger, and he wanted to be found dead in a hotel room. So he tried to buy a gun. But Miami have a strict gun rules and they wouldn't sell him one. People say, why didn't he just go to London or go to areas in Nottingham or somewhere that he could have bought a gun? But you see, he didn't know that. And he sincerely didn't know that because, again, he'd lived in this bubble. So what he's seeing on television and what he's seeing in films is his reality. I got him back, but it was like finding a needle in a haystack. But the determination of a mother or a person when they want something, they can do it. If you don't give up on something, you'll get it. And that's what happened. I got him back, but I didn't get the same child back. He was held by the police at the airport because I'd reported him missing. He was a minor. They needed to check if I was abusing him. They needed to check his mental health. They told me to get his mental health checked, and I did that. I borrowed money from the lady that had taken me in, and we went to a private psychiatrist who said he's got adjustment disorder. And he laid it so simply that, look at what has happened over the last year for this child. Are you surprised there's something wrong with him? He just needs love. But the problem with mental health in this country, and I think a lot of countries, is they try to medicate you. They try to force you to have counselling and therapy. And all he needed was time. I gave him a lot of time. I gave him 3 years. He didn't speak to me, nonverbal. It became just a text. So I communicated by text. I allowed to be on his terms, but I gave him boundaries that he can't shout at me because he was becoming abusive. You can't slam the door in my face. I won't allow that. But it was his way of venting himself, getting his anger, his frustration out, and they take it out on the person closest to them. So if you are in the situation with a child that seems to be very volatile, you've got to really take a step back and not make it about you and make it about them. I never, ever believed he would speak to me, and that's the God's honest truth. But a friend died about 6 months ago, a very close friend. We don't have many people in our lives, and that affected him. And there was a shift in his mindset. But he also knows that I've loved him. I've given him that care, that attention. I've given him his space. I feel there was too many noises, too many voices in his head as he described them. And he just needed to calm his own demons and come to terms with them in his own way. He wasn't self-harming. He'd become non-suicidal. I was catering to his medical health, his physical health. I was making sure he was eating and sleeping. So this last year, he spoke to me for the first time. And we even went to watch Spider-Man together, which was a shock to myself. But when you go to watch a film, you normally have to take a carer, and he took me. And I said to my daughter, if I die tomorrow, I'm one of the happiest people alive. And that was my pleasure of the, you know, my highlight of 2021, not the fact I'd done a TED talk, not the fact that I'd done so many massive things on my spiritual journey and the cause that I'm fighting. None of that mattered. All that mattered was that my son reconnected with me. And that's where we are now. Now I'm a best-selling author. My daughter has just finished her second degree. She's now a dentist, not a biomedical scientist, because it wasn't what she wanted to do. And I believe that you have to sometimes take a step back and reassess your life and really follow what your heart desires. My middle son is still up north. He's studying in Leeds University to become a doctor. He's in his fourth year. He just failed, actually. And you know what? That's okay. It's okay to fail, but it's not okay to stop trying. And he's trying again. And he's invested his time and effort, and he will get there. Life's not always a straight line. Mine has never been a straight line, and I don't want it to be. I'm happy for the twists and turns. It's turned me into an empathetic, understanding person that wants to love everybody, because I love me so much, because I let go of all of the things everybody had told me. I am good enough. And this external body that we're given doesn't mean anything if you're not happy from within. So it's almost like putting a plaster on a wound by putting makeup on and doing your hair in a certain way, wearing a wig. It's not going to really do the job unless you start loving yourself from within.
Nina, thank you. Thank you for sharing that story. I mean, everybody's got a story to tell, but yours is significant. So part of this conversation also brings us on to you being an advocate for human trafficking and that fight against it. And I'd really like to get some of that backstory and just to understand why that forms such a powerful part of your life.
Yeah, definitely. So in 2015, when I left my marital home, my partner, as I say, with my child, and I was going through my own journey, the police tried to contact me, and I thought it must be because he's reported me missing or something to do with him. But the police were after me because they wanted to interview me, as my father had been arrested. He had had a child out of wedlock, so he'd had an illegitimate child who was a girl. And when she was six, he'd abducted her and taken her to a few countries in Europe, and then ended up putting her into what was known as a boarding school in the north of India. They had tried to go to the boarding school to bring her back, but they weren't allowed access, which was a little bit odd. And the tabloids described it as a prison. So I wasn't sure what had happened. I felt he'd taken her over there to kill her to save face, because he'd had this child nobody knew about and he was trying to hide the secret. The police obviously got a report of the missing child because the mother reported it. Normally in these circumstances, the parents don't report a child, so nothing gets done about it. It's deliberate. But on this occasion, the mother, she reported the child missing, and the police had to investigate, which led to an arrest. They said that without a body, they couldn't press charges for murder, so they were arresting him for abduction. They asked me what I thought, and I said, well, it's quite a common thing to take somebody to India to kill them, so I imagine that she's no longer with us. And, you know, I was really fixated on the fear that she would have gone through as a six-year-old that I had as a 21-year-old, and it was really heartbreaking. But later on, I came to question that. You know, years later, I started to think, who was she? I didn't even know her name. And I actually started to have this realization that I had a sister. And maybe if I had reported my father and been more adamant to the police that I wanted to press charges, if I'd been more brave and held him accountable, he may not have taken this action. And I'm not blaming myself. What I'm trying to say is that these lessons that we learn for a reason. And the lesson was, you have to hold people accountable. Otherwise, they do the same thing over and over again. And he did. And somebody that works with human trafficking and saving human trafficking victims in America asked me what I knew about the case, and we looked up some newspaper articles. There were several. He said he wouldn't tell me the name of the school because he said it wouldn't be good for my mental health, because I'd want to go over there and start trying to break the doors down. So he said, for your own safety, I won't tell you, but I've narrowed it down to where she is. And it's a place that they traffic young girls as servants to the Middle East, places like Dubai and Kuwait. He said they also allow the children to grow to a certain age, and then they'll kill them and harvest their organs. And he was quite sure that that was the place that she is. But having worked in human trafficking with the organisation that I'm involved with, I know that sometimes we have cases where people have been in the whole trafficking industry for 15 years and come out of it alive, albeit not in a great state. So I try not to give up hope. And also I realised that she may not be there, but there are a lot of girls that are, and to me, they are also an extension of her. They are my sisters too. So that's the reason I fight so hard for this cause.
What is the name of the association?
It's Youth Underground. It's an organisation based in Switzerland. They've been going for a long time. They're called Youth Underground, and they give a lot of support to victims when they come out of trafficking, because there doesn't seem to be a lot of support for that person. They've built up like a family almost themselves. When you're in trafficking, you build up like a rapport with the other people that are in that situation. And when you come into the other side of the world, when you're released, when you're allowed to be free, you don't really know what to do with that freedom.
And this is territory that one could probably talk for weeks upon, because it's so vast, and so I want to be careful where I go with this. But the one question that does jump into my mind, that is just out of sheer naivety and ignorance on my part, is that having that set up in a country, what is the place of government in understanding that that actually happens? Because I would find it difficult to believe that they wouldn't know.
Well, Youth Underground works with other organisations all around the world, so we're not a minority type of organisation. It's actually a really large organisation. We have a lot of people that we work with in America as well, and there are a lot of organisations set up in America. The main purpose that they have is to spread awareness and to give that support to the victims. That's their main purpose. It's almost like having different parts to a car. I'm a bit of a car fanatic. I like cars. You use the gear stick to change gears for your speed, but if it's raining, you use the windscreen wiper. So almost in that simplistic description, there's another type of organization that will help with the they take the girls from the perpetrators and they save them. So their job is quite dangerous, their job is quite entailed, and they will not really speak about it too much, but they're the ones that will then put somebody in touch with maybe ourselves, so that we can give them the support.
But that the government of those countries where those schools exist, where, you know, you're...
Oh, are you talking about... Okay, yeah, I see what you're saying. I apologise. Okay.
No, I apologise.
There's a lot of corruption, as you know. Money speaks a lot of volumes when it comes to not really getting involved. And it's a big business. Human trafficking is one of the biggest businesses there are out there. It's one of the biggest problems as well because of that. But there's a lot of money involved, and there's a lot more involved, which I won't go into. But people pay thousands and thousands for an organ for a relative that's dying. So harvesting organs has always been a problem. And unfortunately, India is known to be one of those places that supplies them. The police in this country, in the UK, went over, as I said, and they could not get access. So if they couldn't get access with all of their clout, so to speak, somebody like you and myself would never even get past the gates.
Okay, so it's a bigger topic, but there's something systemic.
It's a huge topic.
Yeah, there's something systemic that's going on there that allows something like that to continue, which is probably a completely different podcast. Okay, let's move forward into where you are right now. Talk a little bit. I'd like you to talk a little bit about the book, that that you've written, which I know is very successful, and a little bit about the TEDx as well. I know there's a little bit in the past, but just how that came to be. If we can maybe bring those two things together, and then I'd just like to talk about how it might look working with somebody like yourself in the role of a coach. But let's bring the book alive.
As a child, reading books day in, day out, I always wanted to write a book. And I thought it might be a fairy tale or even my story. And everyone has said, oh, Nina, why have you not written your story? Well, I think that my story probably needs a couple of books as opposed to one. But it wasn't about me. It's always been about everybody else. And that's the way I am. And I wanted to be able to help people with the place that I'd found myself, you know, having been homeless and finding myself now in a good place mentally, physically. And, you know, I'm doing really well. So if I can do it, in my opinion, anybody can do it. So I wrote a book called Master Your Life, Live the Life of Your Dreams. And in it, I have chapters about money because primarily we need money. People have certain stigmas about money, but it's all about keeping that flow going, that receiving and giving. I have a chapter on self-love, which again is huge. I realized that once you love yourself, you become this magnetic source of energy that attracts everything, and you attract happiness, you attract love, you attract success, you attract recognition because you're fighting for something from within your heart, and you're doing that with a purpose, with intention. There's a section on family because I know how difficult it is to love a family that doesn't love you back, but it's also giving you some life skills that I've learned along my way. I'm 51 now, so I've got a lot of life skills and experiences behind me. There's a chapter again on relationships and how you can, not just in a workplace or a personal space, how you can get on with somebody and get the most out of knowing them, building a rapport, and making each type of relationship a success as opposed to a bit of a hindrance or a bit of a pain. You know, I don't want to hang out with her because she's a nightmare. It doesn't have to be that way. It's all about perception and how you address a situation. And then I wrote a section about COVID too, because it's relevant, and how to cope with working from home and the changes. And it's created a lot of confusion, I think, and anxiety with the culture that we're living in. And the other section was about health. And again, I describe a car, and that if you don't put the oil in the car, your car will keep running with just petrol, but it will never run to its maximum capacity. So you need to look after yourself as if you would a car or something. It's been a great success. People have found it very helpful. It's a best-selling book, so I'm super proud. And the next book will be my story. That book led to quite a few things. I've been asked to speak on stages. I speak at corporate places about leadership, about working together, about overcoming diversity. The problem being a woman in a corporate, you know, I've done a couple of those events because a lot of people that are high up within the corporate ladder, they still struggle because they're not treated in a certain way or they're not respected in a certain way. But that, again, comes from within. Once you have that yourself, you demand it without even asking for it because you're that person. You're unapologetically you, not trying to fit into a mold somebody's created for you. I also coach high-level athletes. I've been really lucky. I have really randomly met people at train stations, and I talk to everyone. As I said to you earlier, I give everyone a big hug if I feel they need it. And it's the energy speaks again, that self-love speaks again. But for some reason, I may have a maternal instinct, but I sense people when they're suffering from trauma. And having overcome my own, I'm very good at creating a winning mindset for UFC fighters, boxers. I've had a boxer fly over from Atlanta. I've coached a very successful boxer and also a UFC fighter when he wasn't doing very well. When he went over to Asia, I was constantly coaching him, and he changed his whole perception and understanding and is now one of the best UFC fighters in the world. And I'm proud of that. It's not that I'm trying to validate myself by saying these things. It's just I have this gift, I believe, of understanding, of seeing something. But again, I'm not sitting in that person's mindset. I'm sitting away and I can see how it is for them. So I'm able to direct them. And a lot of it is mindset. You know, you literally can become whoever you want to if you believe in yourself. So that's where I'm heading. I'm also starting workshops, which will be more group orientated for people that can't engage in the 90-day program that I do. So for those that want like a one-off and they just want an hour as a group to work through trauma, maybe listening to how I've dealt with things, what giving them some ideas of how they can deal with things. And if they've got that sort of block that they've got, that they're not able to progress and they're wondering, why can't I get the job that I want? Why can't I get customers? Why can't I get more clients? Why don't I get that promotion? Or maybe in a relationship where they keep meeting the wrong person, I just open up their eyes to a little bit more about what it could be and what it more than likely is. And sometimes you need somebody just to sort of point things out for you so you can have that aha moment and say, right, I get it, that's what I'm doing. So I do those classes. I'll be doing those classes in the forthcoming months, just one every month. And that's not really about, that's more about giving back. I'm trying to also help more people than I am at the moment.
And what's your website so people can check you out? I will put it in the...
Yeah, no, great. So it's just my name. It's just myname.com. So it's ninaalk.com. The other website that I have is End Honor Killings, which is I've created it, but I'm working on it at the moment. My daughter's my little techie girl. She does everything for me. And that, as I said, will be becoming a registered charity because I do want to be in a position where if I'm asked by somebody who needs help, I'm able to give that help to them. And my book all sales actually go to my non-profit organisation. So it all goes towards me helping others.
Okay. And one of the things that I think I heard in there from you is this, and my phrase for it is around patterns and the patterns that people get into. And that's something that I think probably everybody has to a greater or lesser degree, positive patterns that almost when they run the internal script, something good comes out of it. But if they press the button, they can also run a negative script and something bad comes out of it. And am I hearing you correctly that that's that kind of work that you're doing, helping people, particularly in the coaching space, around how they verbalize to themselves the patterns that they have, the habits that they've got, and creating new outputs for them? Have I understood that correctly?
Yeah, quite so. I mean, I don't want to compare myself to a doctor, really, but when you go to a doctor's and you've got a cold, the doctor doesn't even need to ask you symptoms half the time. They know by looking at you because they've done it so many times. It's like you teaching someone how to do a podcast. You've done it so many times. You know exactly what to do with the microphone you need, all the equipment. You know what you're doing with the editing. I was at, my daughter took me away on the weekend. We just went away and I instinctively knew the boys sitting around the area we were MMA fighters and jiu-jitsu fighters. I knew they were in the martial arts field. And I said to them, they were talking about a competition. And I asked them, I said, do you think you deserve that win? And he just looked at me, gone out. But he started to talk to me because they often do. And it's the same thing over and over again. When you're preparing for a wedding, a fight, a job, an exam, it's that build-up, that constant build-up. And then after you've done it, it's like, what now? What do I do now? It's quite an unusual feeling. But with a lot of the winners, they don't believe they deserve that win. Mm. They marry the person of their dreams. Do I deserve her or do I deserve him? And they question themselves. And a lot of it is self-belief and self-love. And that's why I said a lot of it will come to that. It might sound all wishy-washy, but it's not. It's a true thing. That once you believe in yourself, once you love yourself unapologetically, you accept things, you celebrate yourself and others celebrate it with you.
I think that's something very powerful, particularly in the business world. I'm now 52, so I've got 12 months on you, but we're basically the same age. If one of us is
I'm only 52.
One of us is looking significantly better for it. I'll let the world decide which one it is. But I think there's something there that when I was in my early 20s, early 30s, it was all about the fight. It was all about the struggle. It was all about the best person wins and being tough and being strong. And then I moved over the last two or three decades into coaching execs. I'm coaching people of a certain age. And they know technically what to do. They have the skill and the general way. Yeah. And if anybody asks them what they should do, they probably tell them what to do. But they're blocks around something that's going on for them at an emotional level. I'm not talking about becoming a psychiatrist for them, but there is something there about very often the most successful people, which almost seems unbelievable to people looking from the outside in, are riddled
with
uncertainty and doubt, and it's driven them for years. So it's good that you say that, and it's good that
you know. I'm coaching one of Conor McGregor's coaches at the moment, and he started a new business venture. Now he's been with Conor from the beginning. He's coached him, and he was actually one of the best fighters in Ireland before Conor. But again, it's that, well, the business isn't my field. Can I do it?
Mm.
You know, it's just having that confidence. And sometimes someone just saying to you, well, you know what? You've got a great product. Why can't you do it? And that just that slight shift of having someone that says to you, but there's always a blockage. There's always something. There's always an anchor that we're carrying around and we don't know it. That anchor that sort of weighs us down. And that's what makes us feel tired sometimes of life. It's just finding what it is and dealing with it, because we put things in our pockets and think we'll deal with that later. Or you have jobs on your to-do list and you think I'll deal with that later. And it's always the small jobs that you'll get done and not the big ones, because they take a bit more effort. And it's just facing some of those things and talking through it. And also knowing that you're not the same person you were 20 years ago, Guy. You're this person now. So if I'd met you 20 years ago, I might have thought something totally different. And that's accepting yourself as well, accepting that you might have made mistakes, that you might have been in a position where you were helpless, but you're not there now. And what can you do now? How can you create that life you want? Because you deserve it. We all do.
It's very interesting. I think there are things sometimes I think I'm not the same person I was 20 minutes ago, because you have a revelation, you have a moment. And there are things I haven't dealt with for 30 years that I've only just dealt with in the last few months, and then things that I can deal with great ease that somebody else might, that might be their struggle, right? So I think this is another thing to recognise, isn't it, that your battle is your own.
Exactly. And there's no shrinking it. You know, it's often people shrink their trauma, but trauma is trauma. It doesn't matter whether you've lost a pair of keys and that was your favourite car, and now you're going to have to try and find the money to get the replacement set, or you've lost, I don't know, a dog or a cat or whatever the job, or a job. You know, it's still trauma to that person. We're not in a position to judge, or we should just support that person.
Listen, I've been overwhelmed and fascinated and touched and motivated by this conversation thing. I can see that passion and that drive in you, and it's a beautiful thing to see. And as an observer, I think it's something that the way you are today is an absolute testament to, without really knowing you other than this conversation, to the who you are. And that seems that's fantastically powerful. So just on a personal note, I want to say thank you for making that time to have this conversation. And I'm going to make sure all your details are there for people to connect to you. Are you on social media, on an Instagram?
I'm on Instagram. I'm Nina_TheBrick, you know, quintessentially British. But I also have one there called London's Life Coach, which is more to motivate people, and people can contact me. I also have my own YouTube channel, which is London's Life Coach. And I've done one, a couple of interviews, so I'm sort of putting them out there. Again, I'm looking for it. It's a little bit more controversial, because that's who I am. About the array of emotions that you describe. Well, life is a roller coaster, and you know, we're all here to ride it. So why not have a good time doing it?
Yeah. So listen, I'm going to get all of those details from you when we've in due course, and I'll put it all up there. So just from me to you, it's been an absolute joy. Thank you so much. And I think I just would suggest that anybody that's listening to this, get the book, look at the YouTube, make contact if it's relevant for you to do so. So Nina, from me to you and anybody listening, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Guy.
That's it. So I hope you enjoyed the episode. Please share so others get to hear about us, and subscribe so you keep up to date on new episodes. Also visit livingbrave.com if you want to connect with me and find out more about executive coaching, team effectiveness and changing culture. Oh, and of course you can buy my book Living Brave Leadership on Amazon. So on that note, see you soon.